Pope Leo convened his first consistory of cardinals this week. What ended up on the agenda? Former head of the Vatican's doctrinal office, Cardinal Gerhard Mueller, is here with an update. President Trump captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, charging him with narco-terrorism. What's the real reason? And is there a China angle? Congressman Carlos Jimenez of Florida and foreign affairs expert Gordon Chang are here with analysis. And protests are erupting across Iran. Is the Iranian regime on the verge of collapse? And what comes next? Middle East policy expert Dr. Waleed Faraz and democracy advocate Cameron Consorinia will tell us. The World Open begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome and a happy new year to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we enter our, wait for it, 30th year. Can you believe it's been three decades already? Oh, boy. I'm glad they hang me out in a nice oxygen tank. I'm trying to maintain my youthful appearance. Anyway, we are commemorating with you and for you throughout 2026. Stay tuned for that. 30 years. We'll be celebrating it along the way. Meanwhile, an important story this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I am at Raymond Arroyo or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Nearly 170 cardinals gathered at the Vatican this week for Pope Leo's first extraordinary consistory, a two-day meeting that's being called the most significant gathering of the College of Cardinals in over a decade. Joining me now from Rome is Cardinal Gerhard Mueller, the former prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, who participated in those closed-doors discussions. Your Eminence, thank you for being here. I want to begin with the four agenda items, Your Eminence, that were originally presented. Synodality, mission, liturgy, and church governance. The cardinals voted to focus on only two, synodality and mission. Liturgy seems to have been left off the table. Cardinal Mueller, given the enormous controversy surrounding Traditionis Custodes, that was Pope Francis's restrictions on the old Latin rite, the traditional Latin Mass, and the direct impact on the laity, how could the liturgy not make the cut?
Yes, it was a discussion in the consistory between the cardinals and the Pope, and the Pope proposed for subjects. And the great majority spoke about the new evangelization and should all be included, the other aspects, including the liturgy. Liturgy, because liturgy is a culmination of the Christian life, the adoration of God, the presence of Jesus Christ in the Holy Sacrament. And also the Church have to discuss how to go on with these questions about old and the new rite. But the basic conviction is that the Holy Mass is the center of the Christian life. And about this is no discussion. Discussion is about how to use the older form of the Latin rite or the new form of the Latin rite. And I think the Pope Leo will find a good solution for everybody.
But it didn't come up in the conversation. You know, was there a sense in the room that liturgy was too divisive, or they didn't have enough time to really dive into that issue? Or what were you hearing from other cardinals?
Yeah, it's not the central question for the Church of today, because we are living in these times of secularization. Atheism in some anti-Christian great political systems, and we have the woke ideology and the wrong anthropology, which are absolutely in contradiction to the Christian understanding of the dignity of every body, that we are called to become daughters and sons of God in Jesus Christ. And therefore, because the time was limited, they preferred, the cardinals, to speak about this great challenges of the church and not so much about aspects who are inside of the church.
Your Eminence, the church's mission and synodality were the two topics of discussion chosen by the cardinals. This is what they focused and spent time on. Now, this Francis era effort, if you will, to democratize the church, synodality, remains controversial. Bishop Robert Barron here in the United States, before the consistory, said synodal meetings are useful, but they shouldn't be a defining permanent feature of the church's life, lest we lose our verve and focus, he said. He also lamented the impetus to debate doctrine. You yourself have been critical of the German synodal way and the notion that synodality leads to lay governance. What does Pope Leo want from this conversation on synodality that wasn't already achieved at the two synods on synodality?
Yeah, Pope Francis, all the time, he rejected the so-called democratizing of the church. He said the church is not a democracy. But he was not becoming very clear what is the synod of the bishop and the institution of the hierarchy and the collegiality of the bishop, and the other side of the synodality as an abstract word is a cooperation between lay people on the basis of the common priesthood and the priests and the bishops. And we have synodal councils, parochial councils in the parishes and in the dioceses. That is no problem. But the problem was the mixture between the synod of the bishops and the so-called synodality and the bishop and the cardinals. That this must be clear. We must distinguish the synod of the bishops, where the bishops are present on the authority given by Jesus Christ, magisterium, jurisdiction. On the other hand, it's very clear for us that we have to cooperate with lay people, with the religious and with the priests.
Yes. Your Eminence, if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is the cardinals during this consistory, were they trying to define and separate the synodal way from a synod of bishops so that it was very clear? Is that what you heard?
Yeah, it is absolutely clear according to the Catholic theology and the doctrine. But in the last times was a little bit confusion in some heads. But now this is wanted to make it very clear on the basis of the Catholic ecclesiology of our understanding that we are the sacramental church, we are not the Anglican church or Protestant church, they have other understanding as we, but we as a Catholic church, we have the hierarchy, the sacrament of order and the primacy of the Pope and the bishops as the successors of the apostles with their certain mission.
You have been so vocal about trying to distinguish clearly what Catholic doctrine requires of a synod and the role of a bishop. My question is, did your fellow cardinals agree with that idea during this consistory? Was it raised?
Yes, I think this is becoming clearer and clearer. This synodality has nothing to do with the parliament in a democratic state, because the church is not a state. The church is a communion of the faithful, is a sacrament for the salvation of the world in Jesus Christ. And therefore, all these political models are not sufficient for the church.
Well, Your Eminence, what did you make of these small groups at this consistory? It was very organized. It was not an open forum. You and the College of Cardinals only had two 45-minute sessions to speak freely and raise interventions before the entire College of Cardinals. Everything else were really small group discussions. Was that format constructive in your mind for advising the Pope?
Yes, well, the method was used in the last synods, but we can discuss this, not a dogma. This method is more a sociological form. And the classical form is that the cardinals are coming together, speaking about a subject presented by the Holy Father, a question put by the Holy Father, and everybody should intervene with a well-prepared sermon or well-prepared speech of 3 or 4 minutes. That is the classical form, and I think a lot of the cardinals are desiring to come back to the classical form. I personally prefer we are speaking all together in the plenum, and then at mm-hmm. the end we can form some small groups for conclusions, and then we can make exchange of the conclusions made by the small groups, and not beginning with the right. small groups, but ending with the small groups.
Do you think forthcoming consistories with the Holy Father will have that classic model where the cardinals can once again speak in an open forum? Is that the sense you got from these discussions?
Yeah, I think we are asked to give our comments directly to the Holy Father. And I think a lot of cardinals will discuss the forms to look for the best form of the exchange of our opinions.
You've been outspoken, Your Eminence, about the crisis in the church. In a recent article, The Cause of the Crisis of the Church and How to Overcome It, you addressed many of these issues directly. Were any of your concerns, doctrinal clarity, the marginalization of traditional communities, the need for strong episcopal leadership, were any of those issues raised during this consistory among your brother cardinals?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of cardinals on this understanding, this line. And we need the clarity of the doctrine, because our doctrine is not only a confusion of some individual subjective meanings, but the doctrine of the Church is a representation of the Word of God in Jesus Christ, given to His Church for all the time in the Holy Scripture, in the apostolic tradition, and in the special authority of the magistery of all the bishops together, and the Pope in the succession of the Apostles and St. Peter. And that must become very clear. Catholic faith is based on the faith and the doctrine of the Apostles. That is the basis and the fundament of the Catholic Church. And only the Catholic Church is in the full tradition and succession of the Apostolic Church. And that is the speciality of the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Cardinal Mueller, speaking of mixing ideas from different spirits, UK Cardinal Timothy Radcliffe delivered the opening meditation on Wednesday to all the cardinals. He is a controversial figure. He's advocating for moving quickly on female deacons. He's written about falling in love with a woman after his ordination. In his meditation, he said the church is facing terrible storms, sexual abuse, ideological divisions, and that if the cardinals remain hidden on the shore, they won't meet Christ. He also said a church which is miserable can't preach the gospel. Your Eminence, what was the reaction to Cardinal Radcliffe's message? And does it concern you that someone with such progressive ideas and views set the spiritual tone and table for this gathering of cardinals?
I don't want to comment him directly, but I want to say that the crisis in the church is man-made by this doubts about the orthodoxy and the heretical ideas. If the diaconate of women is possible or not doesn't depend on the subjective meaning of cardinals or bishops, but is rooted in the apostolic tradition. That's one sacrament in the three degrees, bishop, priest, and deacon, can be conferred only to male Christians, and that is belonging, is an element of our Catholic faith, and there are some declaration of the magistery in the past, in the times of John Paul II and Benedict XVI made it very clear. And also, we believe in the matrimony of man and woman that is rooted in the creation and in the salvation in Jesus Christ, the matrimony and natural truth and also supernatural truth, because sacrament, the matrimony between one Christian woman and man, is a sacrament. And therefore, all these confusions in the church are coming out from heretical ideas, and the confusion is not coming from outside, but from inside. St. Augustine, the great hero of Pope Leo, had to do with so much, a lot of heretics, the Manichaeists and the Pelagians and the Donatists, but at the end he said, the Catholic faith, that is the master inside of the Catholic Church, and not self-made ideas.
That's like manna for everybody listening, I know. Your Eminence, before I let you go, Pope Leo continued his emphasis on the Second Vatican Council and the actual words, the letters of the Council at this consistory. I want to get your thoughts on this. Here's what the Pope said.
Mentre avvertiamo la chiamata di non spegnere nella profezia e di cercare ancora vie e modi per attuarne le intuizioni, sarà importante conoscerlo nuovamente da vicino e farlo non attraverso il sentito dire o le interpretazioni che ne sono state date, ma rileggendo i suoi documenti e riflettendo sul loro contenuto. Si tratta infatti del Magistero che costituisce ancora oggi la stella polare del cammino della Chiesa.
Cardinal Mueller, is the Pope trying to distinguish the letter of Vatican II from the spirit of Vatican II and this synodal way we've been hearing about in recent days?
Well, that is not possible, because the doctrine of the Vatican II is a doctrine of the Catholic Church in full community, continuity. And we had also 400 years the lecture, the re-lecture of the Council of Trent was very shaping the Catholic faith and the articulation, the catechesis, and our spirituality, on the understanding what is the bishop, the ideal of the bishop, formulated by the Council of Trent, but also a lot of misunderstanding in the doctrine of the grace. There were about the original sin, and so was also misinterpretations. And also after the Vatican I, we had misinterpretations. And also after the Second Vatican Council, those who spoke about the so-called spirit was not the spirit of the council. This is only the Holy Spirit, was their own spirit, misusing and misunderstanding some texts or some presupposed text. But if you are reading as a theologian, as a good theologian, a good Catholic, what the council is saying, you can find the hermeneutic key. I mentioned it before. The first 10 articles of De Verbum, the self-revelation of God the Father and Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit, the presence of the revelation in the Church, in the creed of the Church, in the liturgy of the Church, and the responsibility of the magisterium of the bishops together with the Pope as principal of the unity. And therefore, I think it is good to make read and to study the texts of the Vatican Council, but not in a progressistic sense of an ideological sense, but in the line of the Catholic hermeneutic.
Before I let you go, whatever the prophecy of the Vatican Council that the Pope referenced, is there an awareness among the cardinals about the legacy of Vatican II, which, I mean, if you look at the data, decline in mass attendance, a lack of moral clarity, a decline in vocations, all of that in the wake of the council. Mm-hmm. Do the cardinals consider that at all? The way the council worked its way into the life of the church?
Yeah, I think this was a temporal coincidence. But the roots of this decline of the church are going back to the critics of the religion in the 19th century and the Enlightenment, where they denied the supernatural revelation and the misunderstanding of the church as an innerworldly NGO and not as the work of Jesus Christ, the body of Jesus Christ, the temple of the Holy Spirit. And we can overcome the crisis in the church, outside, in the mankind, if we accept that God himself is a subject of the self-revelation and the salvation of everybody, but inside of the church, and the church is a sacrament of the salvation of everybody in Jesus Christ. And the Vatican Council wanted a renewal of the liturgical piety and spoke in his documents about priesthood is absolutely necessary, constitutive for the church. What is the mission of the bishops and the popes? And you will find no text in the Vatican Council be responsible for this decline.
Your Eminence, Cardinal Gerhard Müller, we thank you for your time. We'll be checking in with you in this new year, and Happy New Year and a blessed one to you.
Happy New Year for all.
The arrest of Nicolas Maduro, who is now being charged with narco-terrorism, is creating ripples throughout South and Central America and the world. Here for what it means to Venezuela and the world is Congressman Carlos Jimenez of Florida. And to help us make sense of the role China might be playing in all of this, we're joined by China expert Gordon Chang. Gentlemen, Happy New Year to you both. Congressman, you were briefed on this operation as a member of the House Armed Services Committee. What was the legal and strategic justification for this effort? And Democrats are saying Congress should have been consulted.
Well, Democrats are saying that absolutely have absolutely no idea what the law says. And so the legal justification was that Nicolas Maduro was a fugitive from American justice. The Biden administration had put a $25 million bounty on his capture. We had doubled that to $50 million. He is the head of a narco-terrorist state. He is the head of a cartel that has been responsible for the deaths of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Americans, in addition to other illicit activities that are in his charging documents. And so the legal basis was that we went in to arrest and arrested Nicolas Maduro and brought him back to American justice.
Congressman, breaking today, the Senate just advanced a war powers resolution that would block any further military action in Venezuela without congressional approval. Do you support that? I know five Republicans in the Senate joined Democrats in advancing that resolution, War Powers Act.
Yeah, I don't support it. And I'm actually disappointed that some of my Republican colleagues on the other side of the other side of Congress supported it. The president, this was not a military action. They needed the military in order to carry out a law enforcement action, because it would have been very difficult for a number of FBI agents to go down to Venezuela and actually arrest Nicolas Maduro. The military was just there to make sure that they were safe and capture Nicolas Maduro and, again, bring him to American justice. It's very similar to what happened with Noriega in Panama, you know, a number of years ago. You know, he had charges brought up against him, and the United States went in, arrested him, and brought him back to the United States to face American justice. The same thing is going to happen to Nicolas Maduro. It is unnecessary. It's actually, I don't even know if it has any teeth, to be honest with you, because this is not an act of war. All right. The military is there to help us arrest people that are under indictment by the United States. There are still a number of Venezuelans in Venezuela, part of that regime, that are there, that are under indictment and have bounties on their heads. So I'm not sure that this particular action resolution by the Senate will have any effect and or deter the president from taking the actions that he has to take in order to arrest these folks that are under indictment here in the United States.
Gordon, from a strategic standpoint, does the Senate resolution broadcast weakness to Beijing, to Moscow, that America's legislative branch might pull the plug as they move ahead here?
It signals that the American political system is divided, but it also signals strength in the sense that President Trump is just going to ignore it. You know, previous presidents have ignored resolutions from Congress on war powers. And it just shows that the United States, where it counts, is able to exert its will through the use of force. And President Trump will continue to do that. So ultimately, it's a symbol of strength.
Mm-hmm. Gordon, I want to ask you about the strategic importance of this capture of Maduro, what this does regionally. I know China has been very invested here. 80% of Venezuela's oil goes to China. Tell me what this indicates on the Chinese front. What was dislocated through this action?
Well, actually, the thing that was dislocated and the most important is China's image. You know, you go back last week, people were saying China's a superpower. Many people were saying, oh, China was the dominant power in the world. And, you know, the Chinese were pushing Trump around on trade. And to a certain extent, it looked that way. But what we saw on Saturday night was President Trump using American power to enforce American laws, as Representative Jimenez just said. But also it showed that the Chinese were toothless, because they couldn't do anything to protect their number one client in Latin America, their beachhead, a country that they had put so much money into, not only in terms of investments, but loans. And now we are seeing other leaders in Latin America who don't like us, like Colombia's Petrov. He doesn't like us, but he is now talking to President Trump in tones that are pleasing, largely because he sees that there's no point in trying to resist the United States. The United States is the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere, and even people who hate us now realize it and are working with us.
Congressman, your district is home to thousands of Venezuelans who fled the Maduro regime. What are you hearing from them tonight?
They're joyful. They are super appreciative of President Trump and the actions that he took. And so that's what I'm hearing. Now, what they want is a peaceful transition to a free and democratic Venezuela, which is also what is in the best interest of the United States, by the way. If we really want U.S. Companies, et cetera, to invest in Venezuela, to be safe in Venezuela, they can't deal with this regime. This regime is a narco-terrorist regime. It's just a holdover until we get to what we really need and what the Venezuelan people actually deserve, which is a free and democratic Venezuela. There is a government, a legitimate government waiting to take over. I'm not sure if that's the government that's going to finally be in place when it is a democracy, but that's what we're all hoping for. That's what we really want. And I'm sure that the United States understands that's what we got to get to.
Gordon, I know China has significant investment in Venezuela. They hold so much debt from the Venezuelans. What is the message here for them? How does Beijing read this action? And has this dislocated them in this sphere of influence, in this hemisphere?
Well, it certainly has shaken confidence in China, because although it talked very tough beforehand, talking about how it was going to defend the regime, it hasn't defended the regime. And people in the region can see that. The problem for China is that it's not just Venezuela. It's also Iran. China takes more than 90% of Iran's oil. The Iranian regime is being shaken. So China is now scrambling for secure supplies of oil. And that is going to be, I think, something that's going to dominate Chinese thinking. They right now have suffered one setback after another because of President Trump, starting in May of last year with Trump's triumphal tour through the three Gulf states. I think the Chinese are really worried about the way this world is going, because they can see that neither them nor their Russian friends are able to challenge President Trump when it matters. Remember, Raymond, we seized those two ships, one of them a Russian ship that Russia really, really got upset about, but couldn't do anything about.
Yeah, that Congressman, I know you serve on a select committee about the competition between U.S. and China. Give me a sense of the intelligence assets that were there in Venezuela or that perhaps are still there. It's obvious Chinese technology, as well as Iranian technology, drones, et cetera, the Cubans' support, that did nothing to stop Maduro's capture here.
Absolutely. And so this was a show of force. It was a textbook operation, incredibly calculated and also incredibly, performed. And so, and again, as the professor was saying, China could do nothing about it. Look, the Chinese are all over our hemisphere. They are. And we needed to do something to stop them. Yes, we arrested a narco-terrorist, somebody that was aligned with China, aligned with Iran, Cuba, Russia, North Korea, all of our major adversaries are in Venezuela, but all of our major adversaries are also in other places like Nicaragua and basically Cuba too. And so I think with this one stroke, President Trump sent an unbelievable message, not only in our hemisphere, and rightly so, because we have been ignoring our hemisphere for far too long, but around the world. Look what's happening in Iran right now, where you have demonstrations and the president has said, hey, to the Ayatollah, you better not touch your people, because if you do, we're going to do something about it. And then there's reports that he's been looking for property in Moscow. It sends an unbelievable message. And look, if Iran somehow falls, the people of Iran can somehow change that regime, that will be earth shattering. And it will also be really bad for the Chinese and the Russians and all of our adversaries, and good for America, because this is really an America first agenda. And every once in a while, we have to flex our muscles. And every once in a while we bark, we actually have to bite. And in this case, the president barked and he bit.
Yeah, the question is, where do you go now? I'll ask both of you this. I mean, the opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, she's still in the country. Doesn't look like Trump wants her to succeed Maduro. Does the administration have a plan to ensure that this doesn't descend into chaos or worse, a second wave sequel dictatorship?
Well, I mean, look, I have spoken to the Secretary of State about this. There is a plan, and it has to be these are waters that we have to tread carefully. There is a stabilization. That's why we're dealing with the current regime. There is recovery. This is the economic recovery for Venezuela, where America holds all the cards. And then there's reconciliation, where they free political prisoners, which, by the way, the brother of Delcy Rodriguez just announced that they were freeing the political prisoners. There has to be The opposition has to come back into Venezuela. There has to be a security guarantees for this, and then a transition to a democracy. And I believe I have a different opinion than President Trump. I know Maria Corina Machado. She is very well respected by the Venezuelan people. All the people in Miami will support her. All the people in Venezuela support her, because they already have overwhelmingly in an election that was held about a year and a half ago. She's an extraordinarily brave individual, bright individual, pro-American, and I have no doubt that if an election were held today, Maria Corina Machado would be the president of Venezuela, and she would be pro-American. And so I have a different assessment of that. I don't know why the president has his assessment of her. I don't think he's met her, and maybe listening to the wrong people.
Gordon, we've seen how regime change can go wrong. Iraq and Libya come to mind. What are the particular dangers in Venezuela, given the presence of Cuban intelligence and Russian mercenaries and the Chinese infrastructure that remains there, I imagine?
Chinese, Russian, and Iranian agents are going to try to destabilize the situation. This is different from Iraq, because in Iraq, we had an attempt to change the government, to purge it of Ba'athists. This time, President Trump is keeping the regime in place, so this is not regime change. But as Representative Jimenez said, and he's absolutely 100% correct on this, for there to be a stable government in Venezuela, it's got to be democratically elected. And there's got to be those elections. And I am sure that Machado is going to win. So this is going to be something where the Trump administration, I think, is going to have to adjust its position. And I think that they will. Right now, they're just dealing with a very fluid situation right now. And they're going to have to stabilize it. Once they stabilize it, there will be room for elections. And those elections will lead to a democratically elected government. That's going to be great.
Congressman, talk to me about the oil for a moment. I know we're sort of blocking exports to particular enemy states, if you will, Russia, Iraq, Iran, rather. What is the role of these oil companies in rebuilding the Venezuelan infrastructure and, I guess, ensuring freedom for the people there?
Well, look, I mean, at the end of the day, you have to have a free and democratic Venezuela in order for the United States oil companies mm-hmm. to actually be assured that their investments are going to be protected. And so that's the reason for America why we need a free and democratic Venezuela. But here's what's going on with the oil. Venezuelan oil was sanctioned. And so the way that they were selling their oil was in the black market, at way below market price. And so they weren't getting the full benefit of their oil. Now that we are capturing it and we are using it, we're actually going to be selling that oil at market prices. And so actually Venezuela is going to make out well with this. But it's not going to go to the regime. It's going to go to the rebuilding of Venezuelan infrastructure. And like I said, there is a plan. The plan is you have to have stability, which is right now the phase we're in right now. There is recovery, which the oil is going to be a big part of that. And there's got to be reconciliation, which will lead to a free and democratic Venezuela. And I'm going to push back on this idea that somehow, this is like Iraq and some other places. Iraq is a nation that there's three distinct ethnic groups that we try to jam together into one nation. Mm. That's not going to work. Venezuela is homogenous, okay? We have the same religion, et cetera, the same values or Western values, and they've been a democracy for a long time. It was only after these thugs and criminals took over that it became a dictatorship. They're yearning for democracy. And so that's what we need to have. And it'll be good. It's the best thing that could happen for the United States, for American companies, and frankly, for the Venezuelan people.
Gordon, I'll give you the last word here. It seems the big loser here, in addition to Maduro, is China. This is the beginning of the end of their influence, at least in the region. Is that overblown, or do you think that's a reality?
It's certainly a reality. Their image as a superpower was punctured. Their image of their military prowess with their equipment. I mean, they were embarrassed that their radars didn't see an armada of 150 American planes. They're going to lose their investments. They're going to lose their loans in Venezuela. They're going to be helpless. And I don't think Xi Jinping is in a position to challenge the United States. The other big loser, Raymond, is Cuba, because Venezuela was supporting the Cuban regime. So this could be a twofer, and that would be fantastic for the region and for the United States and for the Cuban people and for the Venezuelan people, everybody.
Yeah, what a moment. What a week. We'll leave it there for now, and this story is far from over. We'll keep continuing bringing updates as it happens. Congressman Carlos Jimenez, Gordon Chang, thank you both for being here.
It's our pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
You know, we talk on this show about international matters, faith, but the most important issue that shapes all of this are birth rates and fertility. If you don't have people, you don't have much. The U.S., like most of Europe, is now not at replacement level. Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast this week, I sat down with Dr. Drew Pinsky. Of course, you know Dr. Drew, the medicine maven. You've seen him for years. But this week, in an in-depth conversation, we talk about the decline of fertility and the social factors driving it. Are we addicted to our own extinction, among other things?
Tell me what's happening to the birth rates we're seeing in this country. Birth rates are down. Fertility is down.
They're collapsing.
But what's driving that?
Well, we don't know for sure. I can tell you I talked to a lot of young people, and they are not fraternizing. Mm. We have vilified young males. Courtship is a bad word. Men feel like they're toxic and ashamed. And
yeah.
They don't know how to approach somebody they might be interested in. Women are confused. Where are the men? Why aren't they approaching us? They were told not to.
Right.
And literally...
Me too.
I know. Literally, men in their mid-30s are really... don't have the skill set necessary to do dating. So those kinds of things are happening.
Well, and then there's porn.
And then there's porn, and then there's video games. Mm. And so if you look at young males sort of functioning in the workplace and socially... when you see it start to go down, you find porn and you find video games. But porn is the crack pipe. You know, having a phone in your hand is like, if you're prone to compulsion around porn, it's like having a crack pipe.
Wow.
Yeah. And we live in a world where you're not allowed to say anything at all concerning about sexual behavior. Everything must be sex positive.
Yes.
And that's a huge mistake. Yeah. Then we got to worry about men's sperm count and, you know, whether or not, and women waiting too long to have
right,
children.
Right, to have children, which not. Is why the fertility rates are through the floor.
And it is a giant sort of series of unfortunate events.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Dr. Drew Pinsky is on YouTube at The Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart, and subscribe so you never miss an Arroyo Grande show. And it's free. Of course, be on the lookout for Friday's installment of The Prayerful Posse. We talk about that first consistory of cardinals and the fight over the traditional Latin Mass. Father Gerald Murray, Robert Royal, and I dive in. Go to Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. As I mentioned earlier, tensions are escalating in Iran due to severe economic collapse and soaring inflation. Security forces are clashing with citizens in major metropolitan areas like Tehran's Grand Bazaar. The Iranian government is responding by cracking down on rioters and blaming foreign adversaries like the U.S. and Israel, with at least 36 dead and thousands arrested. We're even hearing chants for the return of the monarchy. Is this the beginning of the end of the Islamic Republic? With analysis of all of this and more, I'm joined by Middle East policy analyst Dr. Waleed Fares and Vice President of the National Union for Democracy in Iran, Cameron Consarinia. Thank you both for being here. Waleed, you've been posting on X that Iran's elites are moving assets out of the country. Walk me through what you're seeing on the ground, and is this really the weakest point for this regime since 1979?
Raymond, I think so. You and I have had so many sessions on the evolution of the regime, yeah. of the revolutions, for so many years. We could write a book now. This is the closest to 2009 in terms of numbers. 1.1, 1.2 million people, though the so-called Green Revolution was in one place, mostly in Tehran, lasted a few days. This one is more resilient, it's determined, and it's larger if you add all the demonstrations in all Iranian cities. And what I see as difference, and Cameron can make the ultimate judgment on this, is that they are determined, they are organized. This is not a, you know, a flow of people coming down. The police fears them. The security, the Basij militia fears them. So yes, we are talking about something new. By tomorrow morning, as I've understood, there are plenty of demonstrations today in the capital. 2009 may have been bypassed. So it's much larger than ever before.
Wow. Cameron, your organization, the National Union for Democracy in Iran, works directly with Iranians inside the country and in the diaspora. What are people telling you and what's driving them to the streets right now? Is it the economic pressures? I mean, the currency devaluing, the inflationary pressures? What is it?
Well, you're right, Raymond, and thank you for having me on. It's good to be with you and with Waleed, of course. We're in touch with people directly in the country, whether on university campuses, activists across the country. This started with an economic spark. In 1979, before the revolution, it was 7 Iranian rials to 1 U.S. dollar. Now it's over a million. But this has become overtly political. And the most important distinction in these protests is that we've seen several rounds, as many of your viewers have seen in the past several years against this regime. Those protests were very clear that they do not want the Islamic Republic. They chanted death to the regime, death to Khamenei. The significance of these protests is that they have moved beyond just saying what they don't want and to saying yes to what they do want. They are overtly supporting, as you said in the introduction, Reza Pahlavi, the crown prince of Iran, who lives in exile in cities across the country in nearly every demographic, politically, linguistically, religiously, provincially. We are seeing calls of long live the Shah. This is the final battle. Pahlavi will return. And right now, as we speak, millions of people probably are on the streets of cities across Iran, Tehran, to other major cities at the direct call of the Crown Prince. He issued a call less than 36 hours ago to people to take advantage of this opportunity to come in the millions, to overwhelm the security forces. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now on the streets of Iran.
Yeah. I want to get to the Crown Prince's message in a moment. But Waleed, I want you to give me a little more perspective here. After that 12-day war with Israel in June, where Iran got hammered, we saw this massive crackdown, over 20,000 arrests, religious minorities targeted. There were forced confessions on state TV. Is the regime using this notion of Israeli spies as cover for crushing dissent? And I'm told now there's a blackout on digital information getting in and out of the country.
Well, the blackout, let me start by there. I'm calling on Elon Musk through your show to help them. He can, from space. He can provide internet for the population. We'll discuss it later. But with regard on the ground, what's happening during or at the end of the 12-day war, we discussed that a little bit, you and I. What happened was that Israel was taking out the anti-aircraft, anti-missile capabilities of the regime. Then our dear president destroyed in 3 hours with the American power the actual sites, nuclear sites. This was unbelievable for the last, 10, 15 years. Israel then, the second and third waves, were hitting the besieged positions and the IRGC, but mostly the besieged. The besieged, the militia, are the arms of the regime that crushes the population. The population was so close from doing exactly what they're doing right now. But unfortunately, at the time, and we had that conversation, Qatar came in and said, we can help you, came to the United States and the community, international community, we can help you, but stop Israel. And Israel had 5, 6, 7 more business days. What we see right now could have happened, and the regime would have probably collapsed earlier, because they have one eye on the skies, that would be the allies and Israel, United States, which could still happen, Raymond, and then the other eye on the population. This is why, when the ceasefire started, they started the suppression. They got a respite on the strikes. They immediately went to arrest, kill, you know, the usual thing that the Khomeinists do.
Well, the difference here is Trump has warned Iran that to not violently suppress these protests, saying the U.S. is locked and loaded. And Iran's threatened preemptive action against the U.S., by the way, after those comments. What should the U.S. policy be now, Waleed, very quickly?
Well, I think the president and the administration should apply whatever they feel is a reaction to a threat that is mounted first against the United States and against the moderates in the region, against Israel, against the Abraham Accord. They have the legitimacy to do it regardless of the population. Now, if the regime decides to slaughter the population, they have international law on their side. We have international law on our side. Maximum support for the population and as much weakening of the regime. That's the recipe that will bring a fall of the regime without troops on the ground.
Cameron, we saw the Green Revolution, and that sputtered out largely, I think, because it didn't have support, you know, outside of Iran. Many protesters now have been shown on social media, in media, chanting Pahlavi will return, waving pictures of the Crown Prince, Reza Pahlavi, who's been in exile here in the United States. He's been all over media saying the regime is collapsing. Does he have real support inside Iran? I'm going to show this message and let you answer that. This is from January 7th. Watch.
همیهنانه. امروز چهارشنبه حضور شما در سرتاسر ایران بی‌نظیر بود. و این یه نوع اعلام آمادگی است برای برنامه فردا شب. البته گزارشاتی به ما رسیده که رژیم سخت ترسیده و تلاش دارد تا باری دیگر اینترنت را قطع بکند. البته بدانید که ارتباط ما قطع نخواهد شد چه از طریق صدها هزار دستگاه ستارلینک که در ایران هست و یا از طریق شبکه ایران اینترنشنال و منوتو. اما اگر این رژیم اشتباه رو بکند که اینترنت را قطع بکند، این خودش فراخوان دیگری است برای ادامه حضور و تسخیر خیابانها و از این طریق میخ دیگری را به تابوت رژیم خواهید کوبید. پیروز باشید، پاینده ایران.
Cameron, your thoughts on that, and does he have real support in the country?
You're seeing the evidence of his support inside the country on the streets of Iran right now. Nobody has the power to mobilize the masses in Iran like the Crown Prince does. It's not just about talking the talk. Tonight we're seeing it's about walking the walk. And millions of people at his direct call are in the streets. And you asked, Raymond, before this about the policy that the United States should have and President Trump, what he might do. President Trump's message to the Islamic Republic, that if they slaughter protesters, there will be a price to pay, was extremely positively received in Iran. Look, there are three popular people in Iran. First is Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, Donald J. Trump, and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. So President Trump's threat and warning to this regime was taken very seriously, and it is very important. But I hope, and I want to ensure that the right information is getting to the president, because there is still, we all know about this, that there are remnants inside the State Department and elsewhere who are trying to filter up the information that they've tried to recycle for the past 45 years. Now, President Trump is smarter than that. President Trump knows that the future of Iran is what the street of Iran, what the people of Iran are saying, and that the future of Iran belongs to, and the transitional leadership is best given to those that the people on the street trust, the people and the person, in this case, the Crown Prince, who can hold the country together, who can ensure a stable transition. And right now we're seeing on the streets of Iran, millions of people chant the name of the Crown Prince. And so that's why we know he has the popular support, he has the political legitimacy and the support to ensure this transition. And that's why he's the partner that the West should be engaging. Because that's how we can ensure a peaceful and stable transition here. So you don't need to take my word for it that the Crown Prince has support. All you have to do is look at the streets of Tehran and streets across Iran right now for them reacting to his call and them chanting his name very clearly.
Waleed, assuming this regime falls, what comes next? I know the Crown Prince has been talking about himself as a stabilizing influence and, a bridge to democracy. Your thoughts?
Well, the goal should be, first of all, to make sure that the regime goes down. That's a battle by its own. It's going to take a longer time than what we think, because there will be remnants. There will be allies. There will be also support coming from Hezbollah, from Hamas, from Hashid, from Houthis down in Yemen. So that's number one. And the U.S. and coalition could and can, in a very legitimate way, help the new government. There is an interim government, transitional government, will come simply and take over the major ministries in Tehran and major cities, and then provide immediately protection for the population. There should be an international conference to immediately process the support of the population until Iran and as a country can be on their feet and able to move forward. I am sure that our administration, they have demonstrated this in Venezuela, will be extremely interested in discussing with this transitional government what are the immediate needs, but also the energy matters. I mean, Iran is a giant. And let me say the third point, if and when the regime is going to fall in Iran, it's going to be huge news for all the peoples of the Middle East, because that's a big country. It will continue the struggle against terrorism and jihadism in this case.
Now, we've talked about Iran being the engine and the nexus of so much of the terrorist activity we see throughout the Middle East and the world. Having that regime move off the chessboard here would be a major plus for democracy and freedom around the world. Cameron, the most important factor, it seems to me, at the end of the day here is the people of Iran. Are they prepared for democracy? I mean, the last time the U.S. tried to install a democratic government in Iraq, it didn't go so well.
Well, you're exactly right. And that's why it's so important that we don't seek to impose outside solutions on Iran. If you want to have long-term stability, if you want to have long-term democracy, if you want to have institutions that ensure that this is stable, not just a quick fix or something that works for a few years and then gets broken again, you have to listen to the voices of the Iranian people. They're being very clear in their demand. So what we're talking about here is not importing something from Washington or Paris or that comes from some State Department desk officer or some think tank or some journalist. What we're talking about is listening to the cries and the calls of millions of people across the country. And they're very clear in what they're calling right now. And that's why at their call, the Crown Prince has stepped forward to lead this transition, to oversee the move to democracy, to be able to build the institutions, to prepare the citizens to be citizens, to participate actively in the democratic process, to ensure that in the long term, Iran is stable, so that it can be a partner for the United States, so that it can be a symbol of peace and stability in the region.
Gentlemen, we'll leave it there. Waleed, it feels like we've been talking about this for decades, because we have. Iran, yeah. An Imperialist Republic in U.S. Policy by Dr. Waleed Farez is still available at bookstores everywhere. And you can follow Cameron Consarinia at the National Union for Democracy in Iran at NUFDIran.org. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Before we go, some very sad news to report. Catholic pundit, author, and journalist Russell Shaw passed away this week at the age of 90. His career spanned decades, including a stint working for the U.S. Catholic bishops. Russell was a native of Washington, D.C. He attended Gonzaga and Georgetown University, the author of over 20 books, many on ethics and moral theology. Shaw was soft-spoken and erudite. He was a frequent guest on the world over, really from its inception 30 years ago. Our prayers go out to the Shaw family for his loss, and may Russell Shaw rest in peace. That is all the time we have for this week. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thanks for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.